Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious. And this is a site where the people who build the companies we love and admire come to talk about how they built those businesses. And today I've got a conversation about the founding and the growth of Evernote, an app that, as you guys know, if you've heard my interviews, I use all the time. I actually, every single interview, I have a note on the guest with all my research and Evernote up on my screen. And today I've got with me Dave Engberg, who is the CTO of Evernote Corporation, a technology company that is developing systems to help people capture and retrieve any information they want to remember. This interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I'll tell you more about him and why, if you're an entrepreneur, you should check out his firm. But first, Dave, I want to welcome you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Hey, I asked you before we started, how do I make this a win for you? And you said, you know, Andrew, we're a consumer-facing company. This interview really isn't about me because there's not much that we can get from here, but I want to give back to and especially help out someone who is where I was 7 years ago. So where were you 7 years ago?
Yeah, so in 2007, we had a very small amount of funding and a team of about... I guess like 10 to 15 people doing different things to quickly put together a service to keep track of everything that you want to know in your life. Yeah, all of your memories, all of the details, all the notes. So we had about 6 months to put together a website, a web interface, a mobile web interface, a Mac client that synchronizes all your data back and forth, a Windows client. And at that time, we also had a Windows Mobile 6.5 because that was what smartphones were. And we threw that all together in probably about 5 months and launched a closed beta starting in around Valentine's Day in 2008. And then we opened up to the world out of beta, I think, in June or July of 2008. So, yeah, 7 years ago, we were working 14-hour days every day trying to put together the basic Evernote.
And look at how far you've come today. How many users, how many different clients do you have, and how many paying customers?
Yeah, absolutely. Over the last 8 years, we've tracked about 100 million different people who've used at least one piece of our software. About 75 million of those have created accounts. And on a monthly basis, we've got about 16 million people who use something that we've built. I guess in terms of paying customers, I think it's somewhere in the 20% range, but that's paying us in some mechanism. There's some people who pay us directly with a credit card, and other ways we get revenue by the partnerships that we've got. So there's some bundling, some partnerships, and then some direct revenue.
Partners of yours will buy Evernote premium accounts for their users to make the handsets or to make their products more... more powerful.
Exactly. When we launched, we thought initially that we would be some sort of mix of advertising and direct revenue. We didn't really know what the mix was going to be. Maybe it would be like 25% ads and 75% direct. But as we started working, we realized that an ad-based business model is really hard to reconcile with a service that's built around privacy. You know, we built Evernote to cover the 90% of your life where you're not bragging about your dog and your kids and your dinner. Like it was the antisocial network in 2008 when everybody was only funding social networks and games that go on Facebook and things like that. So we realized that trying to take your most personal, private, personal data and monetize it would have required some compromises that we would have had to get any sort of revenue off of that. We would have had to leak information about you and your content to advertisers. Like Google AdWords won't give you any money at all if you can't let them see the content of what they're advertising with. And that just wasn't acceptable to us. So we built an internal ad mechanism. We got a little bit of revenue off of it, but eventually we realized that the thing that our ads was doing that resulted in the most money was just convincing people that they should pay us, and we decided we'd just do that more directly. Just make it clear that even though Evernote can be used for free for your entire life, actually just suggesting to people, hey, you want to give us some money? That was pretty effective, and we've.
It's a little more than hey, you want to give us some money. It's if you give us some money, we'll give you all these great features like we will make your PDFs searchable after you upload them.
Exactly.
We'll allow you to store massive amounts of data. I actually hired someone to come sit in my office and do nothing but use a snap scan and scan all of my data into my Evernote account so that I wouldn't have to deal with it. And I could do that because I'm a premium member. But if you were now, Dave, to go back in time 7 years, I kind of hate this question, but because it came up before... Because you said, I want to help the person who was where I was 7 years ago, I think it's important to ask it. If you could go back in time 7 years ago and speak to Dave and Phil and the early team and say, look, I want to give you advice from the future, what would that one piece of advice be?
Well, if you have a time machine, I think the easiest thing to get advice around is trends that we didn't necessarily see coming. I think mobile caught a lot of people by surprise. And quite frankly, we sort of lucked into it, you know, being there at the right time with a good consumer productivity application at the rise of mobile was really important. I think that we've learned some lessons over time about how to help third-party developers a lot more. There was things that we did fairly early that assumed that everyone who would develop against our API would be would have as much background and access and knowledge as we've got internally, and that's kind of unrealistic. So things that we could have done earlier to make our API not just powerful, but also a little easier to use. Ultimately, I think in this industry, there's always this perception that if a company is successful, it's because just the folks who were involved just did a brilliant job. And I think really like doing a good job is necessary but not sufficient, and the successful companies tend to just be there at the right time. And
so
we were
doing
there.
A good job and hitting whatever the trend is at the right time, which might explain why you guys jumped on watches. Now I can get Evernote on my watch before really most people have it. I'm living in San Francisco now. I think I've seen maybe 3 or 4 Pebble watches. I might have seen as many Google Glass wearers as smartwatch wearers. So is that the plan, that you can jump on this new technology early in case it becomes a thing that everybody's wearing?
Right. And I think what we're selling to our users is that we will let you capture your memories wherever you are and access them wherever you are. And that means that we look at the new platforms really early, and we try to be there on anything that has promise early. Sometimes that works out. We were there at launch on the iPhone, and sometimes it doesn't. We were there at launch on the Palm Pre. And both of those were good platforms, but it's sometimes you just end up putting effort into something that doesn't pan out. We've got a couple of our clients can do things with Google Glass. We've got something on the Samsung smartphones, and the Pebble is just a project. We've got a great engineer out of the UK, or out of Switzerland, who is from the UK originally. That he did the Pebble project on the side, and it was a great proof of concept. We don't have illusions that will absolutely turn into millions of users, but exploring the idea is important to understand what will work for wearables. I really don't think wearables are going to look like they do today 5 years from now.
So just before Evernote, you were working as an engineer at Core Street. Mm-hmm. You were planning something similar to Evernote. What was the idea that you had in your head?
Right. So Phil Libin, our CEO, he and I were at a security company called Core Street out in Boston, and he'd been exploring the ideas of memory for a long time, and he really wanted to do a startup with something you'd carry around with you that would allow you to just capture your memories easily. At the time, he was mostly focused on it as a hardware problem, so he was trying to visualize, like, what is this thing you could have with you, like an egg-shaped device where you just capture memories, and it's got a camera, it's got a microphone. That was, let's say, 2005. The vision that everybody, like that a billion people around the planet would be carrying around something with a CPU and a camera and a microphone and that was not available. So I think the general idea was something that's been percolating for a long time. But when we left Core Street and decided to go out on our own, that was finding the right place to take that idea and build a lifetime service for memories was our priority.
So it was the two of you thinking about this same idea, which was a device that you give or sell, I should say, to your users, right, and they carry it around with them. Got it.
Yeah, that was Phil's big thing. We had a number of people that we'd worked with before that we brought together pretty quickly to build a team. And there was an existing company in the Bay Area and in Moscow called Evernote that had been doing a note-taking application for Windows. So it was a Windows, kind of a shareware application that was really advanced for its time. It was like much better than Microsoft OneNote, let's say, and had a lot of accolades. But fundamentally, it was targeting the sort of people who would go out of their way to install Windows productivity software. And what Phil had a vision for was a service that would make it more of a lifestyle service that would transcend the productivity niche and make it something that could have more the profile of an internet service that would grow like an internet service, not like a Windows application.
Okay. So with that in mind and that awareness of where you wanted to go, what's the first step that you guys took?
That's a good question. The first step obviously is putting together a team. So we brought in Phil Constantino is someone that I've known since freshman year of college back in 1990. He and I had done a couple of projects before in the past. He came in and took over all of our product development. Andrew Sinkoff, our head of marketing, he was with us at Core Street. And really in the early days, I think the best thing you can do for a startup is bring in a small core team of people that you already know and trust. Recruiting an absolute top tier A-level person into a startup that's hasn't even had an A round is just going to be really, really, really difficult because you're competing with the Twitters and the Googles and the Facebooks you don't yet have the profile of Sequoia saying that you're awesome. So really, I tend to tell people who are coming out of college that, like, your first job or two out of college, like, you're not optimizing. Don't optimize for trying to get a billion-dollar exit in your first job. Optimize for networking with people and finding folks that you would want to work with in the future. The valley is fairly small. A lot of people end up doing 5 or 10 different jobs over the course of their career and find the people that, if you have to sit in a room with people for 50 hours a week working under stressful situations, like, find the people that you won't hate to work with and the people that you can trust to do their jobs.
What did you trust about Phil that made you say, yes, this is a guy I want to spend maybe the rest of my life with?
Right. Well, I guess we have the two Phils. So Phil Libin, I've known him for about 15 years, and he is everything that you'd want in a tech visionary. Like, he's an enthusiast. Like, he absolutely deeply loves technology, and he really loves where it's going. So he's the optimist who can see the future and communicate why it's awesome, and everybody else can come along for the ride. I'm more the dark side of the yin yang, where I'm pretty good at finding all the things that can go wrong. So having someone who can spot all the ways that things can succeed, and then I can be the half that looks at all the ways that things could fail and try to prevent failure. I think you need both of those. And in general, I think having a CEO that can communicate to the outside world why what you're doing is very important for the world is probably more useful than having a CEO who can sit around and figure out why the database isn't quite fast enough.
I'm wondering if maybe something I said earlier triggered your concern about what could go wrong. Like, we started out this conversation
right
before we hit record officially, and I told you I want to be upfront about where this is going. We're going to talk about your story, and I want to ask a few questions later on in the interview about security. And I had a sense that something changed in the conversation, and I'm wondering, did that make you say, hey, you know what? We usually have a mechanism for doing interviews like this. The person is vetted. I don't know that Andrew's vetted enough. Where's he going to go with these security questions? Is he going to make my company look bad? Am I going to make my company look bad? Is this a mistake? Did you start going in that direction?
No, not at all. I think literally I spend most of my day trying to figure out, like, what is on the verge of going wrong and try to try to stop it. I mean, like, and that's not like not, a lot of those things aren't sort of catastrophically wrong, but like, yeah, sniffing out that there's a problem with the latest version of our Windows client that is slightly over-reporting some sort of data, like, that's the sort of thing that snowballs over time if you don't get it it cleaned up. So that's like exactly what I was doing right before this call, is trying to track down whether we're over-reporting activity numbers from our Windows client, and that's I think that that's that tends to be that skill of just actually caring really deeply about what's going on and worrying all the time. That's what I would hire for the most for technical people. Like, if I had to choose between someone who is really good at producing a very nice looking demo versus someone who is really good at sitting in a debugger and finding out why something was wrong, I would take the debugger, like, hands down every single time. I mean, like, having one or two people who can just do the shiny stuff and then not actually sort out problems is fine, but in general...
Why the debugger?
Just the ability to sit down with an unknown problem in a complex system and narrow it down to its source, as opposed to, it's really easy to find folks who can just throw out random theories, like, well, you know, it might be this, it might be that, and then they just throw those out and let someone else figure it out. And with the most useful skill, I think, is being able to narrow it down. Like, is it on the left side of the line or the right side of the line? Well, how could I make a test that could establish that? Run the test. Okay, now I've narrowed it down to this 50% of all problems. Now, like, how can I keep narrowing down the problem scientifically such that at the end of the day, I will know that I fixed it. And that's, for engineers, that is what I look for the most, is someone who can, when there is a problem, like, they will sit down like a badger and keep working until it's figured out for real, instead of just trying random stuff and hoping it works.
I have a friend who does that, Bob Heiler, but he will be up till like 6 a.m. after having woken up early just looking for that thing. And then when you talk to him about it, he's like bleary-eyed and nearly nuts because of it. But I understand the significance of it. Most people would give up after 20 minutes.
Right.
So I pride myself on doing research really well. And as you've seen, we even have a pre-interviewer. But there's something here that actually threw me, that you said that Evernote product existed before you as a team came in and bought it out. I didn't recognize that. I'm actually even going on Wikipedia to see how did I not even find it there, and it's not in there. So how did you end up acquiring or merging in with Evernote, the product that existed?
Yeah. So there was a company that had been around for several years before then. I don't know the exact date, but sometime in the 2000s, in the aughts, a guy named Stepan Pachikov put together this team to primarily out of Moscow to build a product called Evernote. At that time, it had a capital N in the middle, which our marketing guy, his first job was getting rid of the camel case so that the capital N went away. But the team that built Evernote, like I said, they were focused on building a really great Windows desktop note-taking application that was competing head-to-head with a part of Microsoft Office from Microsoft, and they did a really great job of it. They had a few tens of thousands of users, and a number of those folks are still with the company. So I think what they had was really great researchers, and the product that they had packaged of Windows shareware was kind of unfundable in 2007. So they had some great ideas, some great technology, and what Phil brought to the table was a team of people who could execute on a pretty significant pivot, which would be build a lifetime service as opposed to a desktop application.
I think Wikipedia does have it wrong, and we'll have to correct it. I'll ask you the same question that Ray Kroc was asked for the rest of his life, which is, why did he buy McDonald's from the McDonald's brothers instead of launching something on his own? Why didn't you guys, as a team, create your product from scratch?
I think we really, like, Phil loved what the guys had actually built here. Like, so we've got some researchers, Alex Pashinsef, that it leads our R&D team, that, like, the things that they can do with image processing to find handwriting, like, it's unparalleled in the world, and it's kind of underappreciated because it's kind of lost in a lot of other of our features. The team that had put together a lot of the underlying technology of the original Windows Evernote, they had a couple of companies before that they'd sold, and they were actually the team that had built the handwriting recognition for the Apple Newton back in the day. They were in the Soviet Union, and they were able to kind of submit a proposal for the Newton handwriting recognition against a couple of Western companies. And theirs was accepted because they had written something that could run on such low CPU footprint compared to all the Western companies, because all the computers they had access to were just a lot slower than what the Western companies had. So they were able to make a great pitch to Apple and move to Cupertino to build that technology. So they're great, brilliant folks. And like I said, we've still got, I think, at least 7 or 8 folks from that team still around. Alex Patrickoff, who is our head of partnerships, he was the IT guy when we started here, and he's just fantastic at what he's doing. So I think being able to come into a team with such great technical depth was really important, and basically made it so that Evernote could launch with a lot of very significant differentiators.
From the beginning, you focused tightly on getting the platform in place, and you built your own hardware, even though you don't recommend that for most people.
Right.
I want to ask about both. Why don't we start with hardware? You don't recommend it for 95% of other startups. Why was it important for Evernote to run its own hardware?
The default would be to be on, let's say, Amazon. Yeah, Amazon Web Services is fantastic. Like, I'm just amazed at what they've built. They've executed extremely well, and I would recommend most folks use that. Amazon is, in particular, is fantastic if your application has bursts. So if you use a lot of networking one day, and then the next day it all goes away because, like, you're running a Super Bowl ad and you're going to get a huge spike of usage. Or if you have bursts of CPU, like some days you're doing 8 times as much activity as other days, and you can just spin up servers really easily. Or bursts of storage where you're just going to upload like 8 trillion images, process them, and then throw them away. Like, that's what Amazon's fantastic at. Evernote, unfortunately, doesn't have any of that. Our networking is extremely smooth and flat. Our CPU usage, same sort of thing. And our storage just grows over time. Like, our business model says, if you upload data to Evernote today, we will hold it forever, even if you're not paying us. Like, we will do it for the rest of your life. That's what we're offering. And that doesn't map very well to what like Amazon prices their storage at. Like, Amazon charges per gigabyte per month. So if you were to upload a gigabyte of scans today, we would pay per month for the rest of time for that. For us, it's just a lot cheaper to put a petabyte of data onto hardware that we run and maintain. With even if we do like 8 levels of redundancy, it's just cheaper to do it ourselves over the long haul rather than paying Amazon to do the storage. So, for us, it's something that I would prefer not to do. Running your own hardware is just a pain. Like, we've had to deal with all sorts of arcane hardware problems, and I'd love to just make that all Amazon's problem. Like, recently, we were having some problems with certain servers were a little bit flaky, and it turned out that the power supplies, the little like modules that you stick the cord into, they needed a firmware upgrade. And I didn't even know that power supplies had firmware. Like, it's just bizarre that the thing you stick the cord into has firmware. So we had to like sit down, go through all these servers, and like carefully take out one of the 2 power supplies, do a firmware upgrade, put it back in, do another one, and it just took like a couple days. It was just really tedious, and that's the sort of thing that, like, I don't recommend most people sign up for that. But ultimately, for our business model, like, you just got to do the math on what your business model looks like and make the decision.
It was that calculated ahead of time. You sat down, you said, "Where is this going? Let's lay it out in a spreadsheet," or did you just intuit based on the data that you just gave me?
In 2007, there wasn't really a great cloud option. Like, Amazon didn't really have a viable option at the time. But, you know, a couple of years later, you start looking into A rounds, and all the VCs are going to say, like, "Hey, why aren't you in Amazon?" And it's like, oh God, okay. So, you know, that eventually forces you to do the math. And we sat down and did a pretty rigorous analysis. And what we found was that probably for the first 18 to 24 months, we would have come out ahead, mostly just on labor savings, that by not having someone who has to go down to the data center and swap out hard drives, like, you can hire fewer people. But we crossed over the point pretty quickly. And I guess 5 years ago, we basically hit the inflection point where we are saving money on a long-term basis by having more operations staff, but paying less for storage.
The platform, you started out thinking about it early, about APIs early. Why?
We knew from the very beginning that we wanted to have applications that had 100% of your data, that you would synchronize your entire account down to your computer. That really differentiates you from being just a web service. I think at the time, a lot of folks thought, well, you know, applications are dead, software is dead, you just do everything on the web. But we knew that the level of engagement and the level of commitment you get from a user once there is an app installed on their desktop is just so different that it was valuable for us. So we put a lot of money into building all these applications. Like you mentioned, like we probably have, I think, 30 different apps that you can install on something, with all the permutations of Sketch on WinPhone 7 and Evernote on, with all those permutations, probably have 30 different apps that we've developed. But from the very beginning, we knew that we wanted a very rigorous synchronization data model that would make it so that you could work on an airplane with our applications. It wasn't tied to just a website. So we designed the API first. So the very first thing is designing what the structured, rigorous interfaces with a security model around every single call first, and then we built our own applications on top of that, even including our web application is built on top of the same API. That's pretty important because stapling on an API after the fact is pretty painful. There's people who've done it, there have been successful web applications that have made the transition. I think like Twitter is a good example. Like they have millions of third-party developers, so it can be done, but it's the more complicated your application is, the more painful it is to try to retrofit a well-structured API onto it.
So when I interview entrepreneurs about their failed companies, often what they say is, we tried to do too much, and we went for all these different areas, many cities instead of one city, many different platforms instead of one.
Yeah.
In your case, I'm looking and you're saying at the top of the interview, we spent months making sure that our app was a desktop app that worked on multiple platforms. We built our own hardware. We made sure the API was a platform that would scale and would allow other people in the future to build apps on top of it years in the future. Why did it work for you, especially at a time when you had limited resources?
Yeah, no, it's tough. There's the conventional wisdom about focus that companies fail if they try to do too many things. But then if you look at companies that there's another set of companies that fail that you basically get accused of not innovating. Why did BlackBerry fail? Why is RIM? I think they haven't failed, but why have they declined? And the conventional wisdom there is like, well, they didn't do enough. So you can fail if you don't do enough, and then you can fail if you do too much. We knew that we were making a fairly large promise. We wanted to be the best place to keep your memories for your life, and we wanted to be ubiquitous everywhere. So the core of our business model was always fairly broad. This was not a very narrowly tailored application. So we knew that for our mission statement, it was going to have a fairly large footprint. And I think that's the important thing is for what you are promising to deliver, what's the least you can do to deliver that well? But I guess as a guiding principle, I don't think that the standard platitudes of focus and whatnot are necessarily actionable because you can get it wrong in either direction.
So it wouldn't have made sense for you to say, we are going to focus just on Windows and Mac, and when you're on those two platforms, we'll make sure that we save your data forever, and then
Absolutely.
Once you conquer that, expand and expand. Would that have worked?
That would have, I think, like if we'd have been more conservative, if we hadn't been there at launch on the Android platform, for example, like Evernote would exist today, we would be a smaller company, would be valued less, we'd have less revenue, we'd have fewer users. For us, part of what our investors were investing in was a commitment to go large pretty early. And that includes what you've talked about, platforms, but it also includes international. Like we staffed up for full localization and internationalization and country-specific PR at a very early stage, year three. We had an international team that was doing all of that, and we've been translated into probably 40 different languages, and we've got local business development all over the place. That was an intentional decision to do something fairly expensive and fairly expensive both in terms of money and time. But ultimately, that was that was setting up for growth down the road in a way that if we hadn't done it early, we would have lost out on opportunities. If we had not made the best version of Evernote in German, then that would have left an opportunity for someone else to build the Evernote of Germany. And the biggest example would be China. Like in China, because of the internet connection to the rest of the world, it's very, very hard to be a competitive internet service without having servers in China. But we knew that for various privacy and political reasons, we didn't want any Evernote data being stored on servers in China. So we put together a new service in China called Yinchang BG that runs on Chinese servers in a Chinese data center run by a team of folks that we've staffed over there as a wholly owned foreign entity. And that was because, like I said, if we did not launch an Evernote in China, there would have been a competitor would have come in and we would have lost out on that opportunity. But yeah, going big is pretty difficult. And I just because we do it, I wouldn't recommend it to most companies.
Not necessarily directly related, but all my data is in Evernote. All of our data is in Evernote. Have government agencies gotten access to your user data?
So obviously we are required to comply with the laws of any place that we're doing business. So we are citizens of the United States and we are required to comply with laws. That said, we've made an intentional decision that as a company that is about storing your private data, our intentional internal policy is to make absolutely every attempt to look after the interests of our users first and the privacy of our users first. So the policy, I guess I would phrase it anecdotally as like, we will push back to the full extent that we are possibly able to do. We haven't really articulated that as formally as Twitter. I think they've really led the way in stating that is their intent. Like they will push back until the point where like the lawyers say they absolutely have to turn over, and then they will turn over the absolute minimum that they're required to do. And that's the same thing for us. And of course, I think we are not legally allowed to say what we have or have not disclosed, but for Evernote, we've mostly slept under the radar because we're not a public communications platform. What is being said on Twitter and Facebook is visible to the whole world, whereas what you're storing in your Evernote account tends to be pretty private. We are not a fairly common place for people to go looking for information.
Have government agencies asked for and received data on users more than a couple of dozen times?
I'm probably not allowed to say that now that I think about it. Yeah, I think that there's specific parts of legislation that certain types of requests you aren't even allowed to quantify except for in some sort of bans. So we are working on a transparency report that lets us say to the absolute most specific allowed by the law what we get. Yes, sometimes it's kind of weird because like some requests coming in that are structured as law enforcement requests are with the full knowledge and desire of the user. So for example, if someone were to lose an iPhone and it's stolen and they want to get information so that law enforcement can go track down the person who stole it, like the end user with their compliance, they can have legal action that comes from the law enforcement. And in that case, obviously, we try to work with the user to get their problems resolved as much as possible. But it's the adversarial ones where we believe that this is happening not at the behest of a user that we want to put the most effort in. Obviously, there's the other end of the spectrum, which is not government disclosures as required by court, but rather government intrusion without your knowledge. We, like everyone else, are now in the unenviable position of spending a lot of time and money trying to make sure that our systems are more resilient against intrusion by government agencies without our knowledge. So, for example, we have data in two different data centers for redundancy, and we recently paid something on the order of about, I think, somewhere like $60,000 for redundant pairs of equipment on both sides of the network tunnel that will do full encryption on the wire of 100% of all the data flowing through it, so that the dedicated least 10 gigabit line between those two data centers can't be sniffed. That's tens of thousands of dollars that I would have rather have spent on espresso and donuts in the lobby and stuff like that. So obviously...
And brain power that you'd rather spend on something that's about protecting.
Exactly.
What about this? If all of my data is in one place with Evernote, business and personal, if Anne Marie, who works here at Mixergy, decides I'm going to sue Andrew for something at Mixergy, can she get access to, or her lawyers get access to all of my data, including my personal journals that I might have uploaded?
Yeah, that's a great example. There is, I learned about this last year, that if one person is suing someone else in a civil lawsuit, there is a form of, they call it like a non-party subpoena, third-party subpoena, where basically your plaintiff can just go to us and demand information from someone else for a civil lawsuit. That's exactly the sort of thing that we want to push back on as to the full extent of the law. Like until a judge declares that we absolutely are legally required or under penalty of contempt to turn over information in a civil lawsuit, we will fight that tooth and nail, because we are the custodians of our users' data, to the same extent that like a bank with safety deposit boxes, like their customer is the box holder. That's how we view ourselves. Obviously, if it does get to a point where a court, a judge declares that it absolutely must be turned over, then we would have to comply within the jurisdictions we operate. But like I said, the intent is to take the interest of our actual end user first.
So let's take it away from Evernote and just take your understanding and pass it on to the entrepreneurs who are listening to us right now. You've been talking more and more about security roadmaps for startups. Mm-hmm. Should a startup be worried about X issue versus Y issue at different stages of the company's growth? Can you tell me what you've been thinking about with that?
Yeah. A lot of the security press, what you'd read about in the tech journalism about security, tends to just be this unfiltered noise where you get all sorts of things at different levels, and it's really hard to know what's actionable, what you should be worried about at each stage of the company. And I think that there's things that you should be worried about when you're at a relatively early stage of a tech startup, and there's things that you could wait till a little bit later. And ultimately, you're not going to have the luxury of hiring a full-time security staff until you're fairly late in the game. There's a few things that I'd pretty much tell everyone is not negotiable, that by the time you've got 50 employees, you need to do it. So for example, you should be using two-factor authentication for every service that you're using at your company. If you're using Google Apps for your email and your Google Docs and whatever else, like, there is a setting in Google Apps as an administrator that you can check that will force everyone in your domain to set up two-factor authentication to be able to get into their email. That's the bare minimum. Like you have to turn that on. It's going to be an unpleasant day and a half while you sort out the people who like I don't know like how to get this going, and you just have to walk them through it. But like the problem is that there's a misunderstanding that two-factor is just about people choosing good passwords versus bad passwords. The real issue is more that people reuse passwords. So if you have 50 employees, I guarantee you that at least 10% of them, let's just say 5 of them, are using the same password to get into your email system as they also used for some service that in the past had a breach, mm-hmm. Steam or eHarmony or LinkedIn or
Adobe.
Even Evernote. Yeah, Adobe, that's a great example. Like pretty much everyone in the world had an Adobe password. When we found out about the Adobe breach, we correlated all the email addresses against Evernote users and sent all the overlapping users emails kind of warning them about that. And ultimately, like, blaming the users, blaming your workers, your coworkers is the wrong approach. Like, just passwords by their nature are just not secure enough in this day and age. People just are, I could not conceive that you could ever remember 100 different passwords for different sites that are all secure. So what you need to do is get a decent password manager. You know, I'm a fan of 1Password, for example, but there's lots of other ones that are good. And enable two-factor authentication. That's the sort of example. You start getting into things like, you know, adding auditing fairly early. Like our admin tools, we've known since day one whenever an account is accessed by one of our support staff because it's necessary to help resolve a problem for a user, that's been tracked from day one, so we can go back and look at all that information. But that's the sort of thing, like at an early stage, trying to understand what you need to worry about early and what you can wait till later is a bit tougher for startups.
I was telling you that one of the concerns I have when I install apps that work with Evernote, and there's so many in the iPhone App Store that I love, one of my concerns is that if I want to do something with one app and it wants access to read my notes, I'm a little hesitant because I don't want them to read all my notes. I just want them to read maybe my bookmarks or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an example of where like the first pass of our API didn't really cover everything that we'd like to do. We built an API intentionally knowing that it would be used by third parties. So from the very beginning, there's no trusted secret calls that our Windows client is making that a third-party app is technically incapable of doing. Mm-hmm. But there is a need for more granular permissions just to protect the users. We don't want a third-party app that comes in and just naively deletes all your notes. So out of the box, we have different types of permissions that we can give to an app. So an app that only creates notes and doesn't need to see existing ones, we can give it note creation permissions without giving it note read permissions. But there's a different access, like aside from the type of thing you can do, there's also the like what the scope of that is. And we're working on something which I think should be launching pretty soon, which is the ability for a third-party application to have its API key configured to be single notebook. So we'd be able to say, this particular application, you know, if this then that, can read notes, but it can only read notes from my cooking notebook. So that every time I put something in my cooking notebook, it creates a tweet or something like that. Like, that'd be great. And I could give read access to my cooking notebook to that third-party service without letting it read my SQL queries notebook. That's something that their third-party developers themselves have asked for quite a while because they realize it's a problem getting adoption when a user sees that the third-party app would be able to read anything in their account. So, that's soon.
You know, I like hearing what's soon coming up for Evernote. I still have it actually subscribed, your Evernote the Evernote podcast.
Oh, excellent.
Where every once in a while you'd like tip off what's coming. Yeah. And then you stop doing it. Why? I love that thing. Especially, like I said, when you reveal stuff. And for a while there, you would come on and you go, we're so sorry we didn't do the podcast for the last 2 months. And then you go into it. Now you don't even do them. What happened?
I know. Well, we had one scheduled for yesterday, and then Phil had a meeting. Yeah, the scheduling gets to be pretty tough, and I kind of miss it. The podcasts are definitely a lot of fun. Phil likes to declare the things that are coming in the future on the podcast, sometimes before actually telling us. So
really?
I guess that's one way to get commitment from your staff is to declare publicly that something is coming. We obviously have calibrated like how to get the most impact out of things that we're doing that are new. Sometimes that's a PR thing. Like from a marketing standpoint, being able to get an exclusive for some big thing we're doing and shop it around, sometimes that actually like would result in coverage in a larger publication than we get if we leaked it on our podcast 2 months early. Other times there's, you know, you're coordinating with partners, like a big launch. Like if we'd have leaked the Telefonica launch where every Android phone on Telefonica in Brazil comes with Evernote Premium, like that's something that would have been pretty bad. So I think it's a sad statement of maturity that now we have to be a little more grown up on what we brag about on
our
podcast.
So here's the answer: don't have Phil on. If it's just you and one other person, it would be golden too.
Yeah, that's true. Although he's the one, like I said, he's the enthusiast. Like on our podcast, he's the one who has the most exclamation marks and, you know, sparkles coming out of his voice. So I think the rest of us would be hard to compensate without him. But yeah, He still likes to get off message once in a while. So you know, it's the blessing and the curse of being fairly transparent. That's
I don't agree. I think anyone who listens will agree with me and think that and understand that I'm not just flattering you. All three of you guys are good. It's three of you who are mainly on there, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks. That's nice. Yeah. And Andrew has. In the early days, he was recording it and just sort of mixing it all himself. And eventually, like, we got better, and we paid $5 for a song from iStock Audio. And the production quality is definitely
improved. You throw in some sound effects. I mean, all kinds of stuff. It jazzes it up. Yeah. You play recordings of your users with their use cases. I love the use case part. You don't even need Phil, I'm telling you. I mean, you need Phil maybe to go run the company, but
I'll tell Mr.
Marketing Guy just call you up on the phone and hit record and publish that. This is like an amateur operation. You see this? You and I are just on Skype.
I already wrote down that Andrew says we don't need Phil anymore, so
yeah, tell that to the other Andrew. By the way, speaking of sparkling, you were essentially there from the start, maybe months apart according to LinkedIn. You and Phil were maybe like 3 or 4 months apart.
Yep.
Phil is listed he's listed as CEO. You're listed as CTO. Stepan is listed as the founder. I see. Wouldn't you, the three of you, be considered founders?
I don't know. Like I said, there was a company called Evernote that had done a lot of really great stuff for years before we showed up. At the last company, we were founders. There was, you know, the articles of incorporation. I wouldn't want to take anything away from the folks who actually were around with the capital N. So I think that the founder versus non-founder thing is definitely a status badge that is entertaining the first time. But at this point, like, we're really motivated by trying to build something cool.
And something cool forever. But do you ever see, like, maybe you have friends. I have friends. I'm now living in San Francisco.
I don't have friends.
You don't have, that's the problem. Well, here's what's going to happen when you do have friends. Especially in the tech space, they'll have sold their companies and they'll be able to buy basically anything that they want. And they're walking around like, you know, in a whole other stratosphere. Here you guys built this incredibly powerful, profitable company, successful company. You ever feel like, hey, Phil, stop telling people we're going to run this thing for the next 100 years. Let's just be open to potentially selling so I can own a jet.
I don't think any of us are really motivated by that. I'm kind of serious I can't remember if it was Thoreau or Emerson who said, you know, make yourself rich by making your wants few. I don't own a car. For a lot of people in the Valley, I think they're motivated by making something that affects millions of people, and then after the fact. For some people, money becomes the scorecard afterwards, and that's fine. I don't knock that, but the fact is, even if you fail in the Valley, like, you know, you do a good salary, you probably, you know, got to wear cargo shorts to work, and like, you worked with people who are a lot more interesting than anywhere else in the world. So I think that you shouldn't be doing startups for money. Like, it's just like the math doesn't work out. Like, it's the failure rate is just way too high. I've got a stack of business cards that my wife keeps of all the different places where I've been a VP of this or something of that, and like, those companies don't even exist anymore. You learn stuff, you get to try new things, and ultimately it's the impact that really drives most of the folks I know.
In that case, then. Other than doing this Mixergy interview, what is the height, one of the most exciting point for you of Evernote? And you can't say being on Mixergy.
That was pretty much it. I think the at the point where we launched the service without an invitation, so we left the beta period and we launched the world, and we had the first person come in and buy Evernote Premium. Now, someone who said, like, this internet service is useful enough to me that I would like to pay $45 for a year to get more of it, to do more with it. We remember that very first person. His first name was Nils, and that is the secret name of our elephant. So the elephant's secret name is No, I'm sorry. I'm Mads. got it wrong. So Mads the elephant represents that one user, and I think that like there's been a lot of really great stuff since then. But getting something to the point where a complete stranger somewhere in Northern Europe just out of the blue said, you know what, like this is awesome. I want to start paying you money. Like that moment was probably the high point.
And you still remember that first customer, the first person, Mads Nils.
No, Mads. His first name is Mads. I can't remember his last name, but I probably wouldn't disclose it even if I could. But yeah,
I thought maybe you could remember it, and I was going to try to get you to. Why not disclose it? Because you don't want to breach his privacy.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. Yeah, okay. Yeah. What an exciting feeling it must be to have had that, but also to now walk around and see your friends will have Evernote on their phones, have it in the dock of their phones, know the people who you care about are actually using your product. Yeah. That's got to be exciting.
Yeah, if you walk down, we've got a commuter rail here in the Bay Area called Caltrain, and you walk down and you see all these laptops open and smartphones, and it's hard not to just like peek at every single screen and see like if there's a green elephant logo on there, and it's pretty amazing just to see the number of people who use Evernote. We have a conference every year, and we go to various conferences in different capacities. And one of the things that our marketing team has to coach people on is that one of the things that will happen if you go anywhere where there's a large number of our users is someone's going to come up and want to hug you. And like, I'm dead serious. Like, you're going to get hugged. And like, that's pretty amazing. Like, at our last company, we made really highly scalable and secure cryptographic software primarily sold to government agencies. We went through common criteria certification with auditors coming in, and we did all that. And I was proud of building something that was useful, but like it's kind of boring. It's being able to see that normal people tell you over and over that you've improved their life in some way, and in something that I feel is a little bit more substantial than sort of transient communication schemes. That if the thing you're using for chat today goes away, you just switch to something else. Like Evernote is trying to make something that we're not curing cancer, but we are trying to build something that is more substantial and is more useful to people over a long period of time.
And frankly, maybe there's someone right now trying to cure a form of cancer taking notes in Evernote. It is so exciting to have seen the growth of the company and to continue to watch it. This is what really, frankly, Dave, this is what entrepreneurship is about at its best, where you create something that you're passionate about. And I know your passion for Evernote, and start to see people's lives get impacted and become better because of it. And maybe even start to see some of your friends use it and realize, hey, I'm touching real people here. And my hope is that as we've done this interview, that someone out there is where you were 7 years ago, maybe even further when you were 15, 20 years ago, and they will build the next Evernote, or they will be inspired by this and build their version of Evernote and do it for the next 100 years. And hopefully, like you, they'll come back and they'll do an interview here with me.
That'd be awesome.
Thank you. I forgot to say thank you, Scott Edward Walker, for sponsoring this. Scott, I robbed you of an ad. I apologize. Anyone who's an entrepreneur who needs a lawyer, please check out walkercorporatelaw.com. I won't sell them. You know what I'll do? I'll just tell you, if you scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see people who you admire talk about Scott, and you will understand from them. He paid me, frankly, for the sponsorship. He didn't pay them for the testimonials. So if you want an unbiased feedback from real customers and real users, check out walkercorporatelaw.com, and you'll see why he is the entrepreneur's lawyer. What do you think of that, Dave?
Sounds great. Yeah.
All right. I saw you looking up there. I thought maybe you were saying, what the hell kind of ad is this? Let's remember to never buy an ad from Andrew. He waits till the end, and then he also doesn't even tell anyone anything. Anyway, thank you for doing this interview. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.